This is Science Friday. I'm Roxanne Campsie. Throughout the pandemic, scientists have been learning more about SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID. But there are still big questions, one being, how long does the virus persist? In other words, how long does it hang around in the body? Persistence can clue us into ideas of immunity and how long people are infectious. And this is a question that researchers have about all sorts of viruses, from SARS-CoV-2 to HIV to measles. My next guest is here to talk about what we know about how viruses hide out in the body and why they might do that. Diane Griffin is a professor of molecular microbiology and immunology at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, Maryland. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, Diane, I had mentioned this idea of persistence of viruses. What does that mean? Like, why is this important to understand?
Well, the persistence can be in several different forms. Mostly when we get sick with these acute kinds of infections, SARS is a good example, but the example that we've been studying is measles. You think that as soon as you feel better and go home, that the whole infection is over. But actually, that's not really the case. Even though the infectious virus that we can actually culture and that makes you be able to give the virus to somebody else is actually usually cleared or gone very quickly after people start to feel better. But the RNA, in this case, that's the genome of the virus itself, actually it takes a much longer period of time for it to be able to be cleared. And that may be actually doing something during that very long period of time that it hangs around.
One question at the beginning of COVID was with PCR tests, which tap into some of that RNA that you're talking about. So is that test picking up the virus itself or fragments of the virus?
Well, it's picking up the genome, the RNA of the virus, and the test itself doesn't really tell you whether it's picking up the whole viral genome, which then could start replicating again if you gave it a chance, or just a piece. So the PCR test itself does not really give you that information.
So, I mean, it sounds like this is very new terrain because we've got these tests now that we can poke into this new question. But like historically, we've thought there's two kinds of viruses, right? Like those that clear out of the body, just as you described. And once you get over the illness, the virus is gone. And then others that stick around for a lifetime, like HIV or herpes. Can you give us a basic idea of how this works, like whether a virus sticks around or not?
Yes. Well, the viruses that stick around that you've mentioned, like herpes and HIV, actually stick around in a form where they're still infectious. And those viruses all have a DNA phase to their replication. So they have a mechanism for being often incorporated into the genome of the host cell so that they are not easily cleared or basically can't be cleared. But other viruses don't have that same mechanism, which is the reason that we've been surprised that these viruses that don't replicate or have a nuclear phase are all in the cytoplasm. They can still hang around for very long periods of time. There's a fair amount of evidence that they're actually at least making viral proteins because they're stimulating the immune response.
Interesting. Okay, so if I understand right, viruses like HIV and herpes, they actually get into the nucleus of our cells, that innermost part, and kind of get into the DNA and integrate there. But that there's evidence that other viruses that don't do that might be hanging around for a while because, as you say, they're making proteins for a longer time.
Right. The ones like HIV and herpes, all the herpes viruses actually have mechanisms as a part of their natural replication for being able to, as you say, hang around for a lifetime usually.
So has our view on viruses changed? Is it still so clear-cut that a virus sticks around or is cleared?
Yeah, so I think our views are changing because we didn't really appreciate that this was an issue whether it's a problem or not, but whether it was an issue with these more acute infections. So influenza, you think of a lot of different, as I say, measles, a lot of different infections where you're only sick for a very short period of time. But now that we have these other kinds of techniques, we can appreciate the fact that actually the RNA or the genomes of these viruses also hang around for very long periods of time.
Well, like, this is now making me think again about measles, what you've studied throughout your career. We thought for decades that we cleared measles. Measles happened, but then it was over, and that's not the case. So there's this study in Japan in the 90s where they looked at people who had measles as kids. What did that study tell us about measles?
Well, it was very interesting because they found, using these same kinds of techniques, they found RNA present in people who were dying and they were quite elderly, still present in a certain percentage. It wasn't that they found it in everybody, but it indicated that it's possible that some of these viruses can really stay around for a lifetime, although they don't usually cause disease during that period of time.
I mean, it's not somebody you really want to hang around with for a lifetime, a virus. Like, it's a little scary to hear about this hanging around with us. But I know that you have studied measles very intensely, and I was wondering, what do we know about the mechanism for measles? Like, why does it hide out in the body?
Well, that's a good question. And for measles, it's hanging out in cells that actually turn over. So these aren't really long-lived cells necessarily. But it's primarily in lymphoid tissue, the tissue where the immune response is generated. So another thing that we know about measles is that it does establish lifelong immunity. And not all viruses do that. But the fact that it remains and continues to stimulate the immune response over a long period of time, maybe one of the reasons or one of the mechanisms that it uses in order to be able to establish lifelong immunity, in which case that's an advantage for the host.
Yeah, it sounds like there's an upside to having a virus for a while. It's kind of stimulating the immune system and keeping us on alert, but not getting too dangerous. I mean, is there a risk of it going awry?
Well, that's a good question, but it's almost an epidemiologic question. But there's not to know whether people are infectious or not. And that's certainly been one of the major questions with SARS-CoV-2 is whether people where you can detect the RNA by this RT-PCR kinds of mechanisms are infectious or not. For measles, it's pretty clear. There's not any evidence that the virus can be transmitted after maybe 3 or 4 days after the rash has cleared. People are no longer infectious.
So why aren't you infectious if you've got measles in your body? That to me is a bit of a puzzle. If it's hanging around for a while, potentially, Why wouldn't you infect other people?
Right. But there seems to be a mechanism, and this is not something that we understand very well, for actually suppressing or clearing what we call infectious virus. And that's whole virus particles that you could actually isolate in the laboratory and that would be what would be transmitted from one person to another. The cells that were originally infected and producing the infectious virus for measles is in the and for SARS-CoV-2 is in the respiratory tract. So viruses being produced in respiratory secretions, and that is what can spread it from one place to another. That virus is no longer being produced in respiratory secretions. Instead, inside the cells that were previously producing this kind of infectious virus, now they're no longer producing the infectious virus, but they still have the genome inside the cells.
One thing that is really important is that for those of us that got vaccinated against measles, we're not going to have to worry about this thing of measles hanging around in us, right? Like if you're vaccinated, you're not going to have persistent measles in your body. Is that right?
I think that's right. All of the evidence is that it is not doing the same kind of thing as the original natural wild type measles does. So it's an attenuated virus. It doesn't replicate nearly as well as the wild type virus.
So with everything that you've uncovered with measles, how are we going to figure out if COVID persists in the body?
Well, I think that, first of all, as I say, some of the, we're detecting the RNA for quite long periods of time that is variable from individual to individual. I think that it will become apparent whether people are infectious or not, as I say, mainly from the epidemiology. If, when they go home, do they infect people in their families, et cetera? These viruses are hard to culture. So, you know, I talk about infectious virus, and that means that you can culture it. At, not only is it transmissible, but you can culture it in the laboratory. But the but that's not an easy test. And people are, for the most part, are not culturing SARS-CoV-2.
So it's, you know, hanging. So viruses can hang around in the body much easier than sometimes they can hang around in a lab dish, is what you're saying.
Well, they can, or then you can recover them in the lab, yes.
And I should say, you know, we're not talking about COVID persisting in the body, but SARS-CoV-2, the virus, just to be technical about it.
Right, right, yes.
So could this idea of persistence be playing into long-haul COVID?
Oh, I think so, yeah. And I think that's probably one of the main hypotheses that is being pursued, is whether there is persistence and where that is. You know, what one of the things that we know from measles is that that persistent RNA is continuing to stimulate the immune system. So a lot of the symptoms of long COVID could be the actual immune response that is being generated, but it may be being stimulated by the virus hanging around, or the viral genome hanging around and continuing to code for viral proteins so that they continue to be made even if you're not making the whole infectious virus anymore.
And, you know, I think that there's debate around latency with COVID, whether or not it hangs around in our body and integrates into our DNA. But, I mean, in your opinion, do you think we should be looking for latency in COVID?
Well, I don't think it's going to, that there's a big risk that it's going to be integrating into DNA. I think that that's one of the interesting things about these RNA viruses, and COVID is an RNA virus like measles is. They stay in the cytoplasm, so they don't integrate into the DNA of the cells. So that's the reason understanding how they're persistent is a little more complicated than understanding it for HIV, for instance.
Wow. I mean, it sounds like it's a big challenge. But speaking of challenges, you are on a committee that has put together a report on genetic surveillance in the U.S. What is the state of genetic surveillance?
Oh, I think it's improved quite a bit. At the time that we put together our report, it wasn't very good. It was much better in the UK, for instance, where they really had an organized system for monitoring these viruses and being then able to identify variants when they appeared in the population. But we're now doing quite a bit better job, so that we're sequencing many, many more isolates or genomes that are circulating. Mainly SARS-CoV-2 is what's being sequenced in monitoring these different viruses and knowing, for instance, right now that the Delta variant is an important strain that is actually being spread much more readily than some of the earlier versions of SARS-CoV-2. We also sequence a lot of influenza viruses where it's very important to follow what the changes are over time.
So that's why it's important to track viruses like this, right? To find out what they might be doing differently based on their genetic code?
Yes, we probably won't find out about it from actually just the genetic code, but we'll know to look for what that different those each so those different viruses is doing and how it's acting in the population as well as in the individuals who are being infected.
I'm Roxanne Kamsey, and this is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. And, you know, taking the long view, you've been a virologist for decades. You know, why are viruses interesting to you? And is there some question about measles you're still itching to crack?
Oh, we have still have a lot of questions. And viruses are fascinating because they can do so many interesting things code for very few proteins, very few genes, but they take over a whole cell and organize the cell to be able to make them, the viruses. And so we learn a lot about cell biology as well as about viruses and what they can do. You know, right now with measles, we're very interested in how you establish lifelong immunity, basically. So we think that the persistent RNA is a clue, but we don't really know how it's doing that. So we're working hard right now to try to understand that and to understand the difference between wild-type measles and the vaccine strain of measles. How are they different?
Well, I mean, I think these are great questions about, you know, viruses hanging around lifelong, and it seems like a question of lasting interest. We've run out of time, but I'd like to thank my guest, Diane Griffin, Professor of Molecular Microbiology and Immunology at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, Maryland. Thanks, Diane.
You're welcome.